The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, third one of the week. We taped this one on Wednesday. It had been a while. We had not called our buddy Jacko about this Joe Torre book that has caused this surprisingly big sports controversy, I gotta say. And most people seem to be against the fact that he exploited his time with the Yanks for a book. Who better to call than our buddy Jacko? Let's give him a ring at work, and he does not know that we're calling.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Oh, Johnny!
Hey, what's up? Long time no see.
I'm sneak attacking you.
What's that?
I'm sneak attacking you.
You are, indeed.
I don't think we've talked to you in like 3 or 4 weeks. I know we haven't talked to you since the Joe Torre book came out.
That is correct.
We have to discuss the Joe Torre book era.
Absolutely. I have not read it as yet.
But you've read the excerpts and you know the general theme. Is this short of like those mafia people that turn against like John Gotti or whoever the mafia head is? Is this the biggest betrayal in American history?
It really is. I'm so disappointed by it. I yielded to no one in my love of Joe Torre. I used to make jokes in the 90s that it was so hard for him to manage baseball while he was at the same time working on cures for cancer and solving the Middle East because he was so wise and leading the Yankees to 4 World Series.
Right.
And then he comes out with this book that's like so petty and just completely tarnishes for me his Yankee legacy. Just ruins it, really.
Because I mentioned in the chat on Friday that, you know, Phil Jackson basically did the same thing with his Laker books, but I really felt like there was a larger goal with those books. Like he was writing about the team and the concept of harmony and chemistry, and you know, he killed Kobe in the books, but he was killing him in a way that meant sense with the book. This Torre book, from the excerpts I read, I haven't read the book yet, just seems like a guy who's bitter about the way it turned out and was trying to get everyone back.
Exactly. And you have to, I mean, putting the whole thing in context, I mean, when he got hired in 1995 and the headline in the Post was Clueless Joe, I mean, he had an under 500 record. He was not really super highly regarded as this wonderful manager. You know, he was doing color commentary for the Angels or whatever. And, yeah, did he lead the Yankees to 4 World Series? Absolutely. But it also resurrected his career. It made him probably a Hall of Famer. It made him millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. It made him a national celebrity. It enabled him to be played by Paul Sorvino in the HBO movie. Or was it an ESPN movie or HBO movie? About the 96 season. Remember who was played by Paul Sorvino?
Yeah, I thought that was an ABC movie.
Okay, maybe it was ABC.
Because it was about his brother, right?
Exactly.
I'm going to look this up while you talk.
All right. So all these opportunities that it afforded him. And, you know, he was there 12 years. At a certain point, it's time to move on for both the manager and the team. And that time came. Now, the Yankees, you know, they were a little graceless in the way they handled things. But they also brought him back after the disaster in Detroit when they got swept the prior year. And he had a history now, a recent history of first-round exits, and they still carried him. So I can understand, believe me, I know I'm Irish. I know about holding grudges and being embittered, but you have to kind of look at the big picture. And, I mean, they're never going to retire his number now or have, like, a Joe Torre day after this. So he's completely, like, burned every Yankee bridge that he ever had. I just understand why he would do it, you know? He needs a few more million bucks, you know?
I always thought that he did a nice job of cultivating this, I'm an awesome guy, I'm a great guy, but meanwhile capitalizing on, like, every opportunity that came his way.
Absolutely, right.
What commercial did Joe Torre turn down? You know, after the Dodgers season ended, there was a Clips game. I forget. They might have been playing the Lakers. It was somebody good. And there's Joe Torre sitting courtside.
Was he drinking his Bigelow tea? Is he contractually obligated to do it?
Well, he was sitting next to Billy Crystal. And I always thought he got off on that stuff more than maybe people admitted. Like, I just don't see Terry Francona sitting courtside at a Lakers game.
He's much more of a media presence, you know. He's always good for cameos and TV things and, you know, going on Regis and Kathy Lee or whatever it's called now, you know, doing all that kind of New York stuff.
Yeah, he did a masterful job of handling his public personality.
Right. And he's like the master of spin control. I mean, he's like his own PR guy, you know.
Right.
So to now come out and write stories about, you know, the World Baseball Classic and Jeter and A-Rod getting jeans, and when A-Rod saw Jeter wearing his, he had somebody like ship his jeans in so he could wear them too. It's like, I mean, Joe, do we really need to know that, Joe? You know.
Well, I like that he's defending it now that he didn't violate the sanctity of the clubhouse.
And the craziest thing is that he has like this automatic out that the book. It's such an odd way the book was written that it's he and Tom Verducci.
Yep.
So anytime he doesn't like something, he'll be like, oh, that's Verducci's part, you know, or Verducci will be like, oh, that's Torrey's part. But Torrey defends it. Like yesterday, I didn't hear it because it was when I was at work, but I was driving home in the snow yesterday, and he was on with Francesa on The Fan. And so Francesa was very proud of himself for getting this interview with Torrey, and of course it was the best one ever. And so people were calling up and talking about the interview. And one of the controversial things in the book, apparently, is that he refers to A-Rod as having a single white female complex with Jeter.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty harsh assessment since Jennifer Jason Leigh basically was like a murderer in that movie.
She was a bisexual, multi-serial killer murderer. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's a rough comparison to make about A-Rod, you know? And when
he's just bisexual. I'm kidding, jokes.
So apparently Francesa yesterday asked him about the single white female stuff, and Torrey said, quote, I don't even know what single white female is. Well, Joe, you're claiming it's your book. And then he claimed that he read it six different times. And there was nothing in there he disagreed with it. But he doesn't even know what single white female is.
Hey, Joe, tell me about the single white female comparison. I saw that movie. The girl was a murderer. That can't be a flattering comparison, Joe.
I mean, you know, you've written a book, you're writing another book. Like, if there's anything in there and your name is on the cover, and then they ask you, like, Bill, what about this part about Oscar Robertson? And you're like, who? What now? You know, I mean, come on. That's a joke, you know?
Yeah. Remember the all-time most famous story about this was the Charles Barkley wrote the book, I think with Wilbon, the autobiography, but then claimed he got misquoted in it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, a lot of these athletes, you know, they write books, quote unquote, and then they're like, they don't even read it, you know. Someone maybe reads it to them at some point, but they don't even know what's in there. But you'd expect a little bit more out of Joe Torrey, you know.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but when I started writing for ESPN.com and the column started doing pretty well, I had this book agent, and the first thing he brought to me, he was like, call me this urgent. And it was an offer to write Tony Siragusa's autobiography with him. It was called like The Goose on the Loose or some terrible title.
Tony Siragusa has told the Bill Simmons. That would have been fantastic.
I would have had to interview Tony for like 2 months, interview the people around him, and write this book in Tony's language, first-person Tony Siragusa book. And needless to say, that person no longer was my book agent.
Within
about a month.
Would some of the book have been recipes?
I don't know. Well, I love, you know, he's always says baby on TV like Tommy Heinsohn did, so I wonder, like, if I had written the book, would I have had to be like, that AFC championship game was something, baby. Like, just basically, the way I would have written it was just to pretend that Telly Savalas was writing it, and
right,
that's how I would have written the book. But, yeah, anyway, that would have been interesting if Tony said that he was misquoted in a book written by me.
Chapter 10, Super Bowl 35, baby.
Yeah. Chapter 10, farting in the huddle.
Right.
Yeah, but back to Torres. So the Yankee, what would you say the percentage, like 50-50, 60-40, 80-20 of Yankee fans who have now turned on Torrey?
Well, based on the calls that I've heard on the radio, I would say that it's like, and just talking to people in general, my own informal polling, I would say that it's like 65-35 against him.
But who, the 35, how do they defend it?
Oh, because he got us 4 World Series and he didn't really say anything that badly, and he didn't say things like so-and-so was cheating on his wife, and he, you know, they treated him horribly, so he's entitled to be angry.
How did they treat him horribly? You were complaining about his managing like from 2003 through when he stopped managing. Like,
no,
he
I know.
Killed his bullpen. He out of any manager I think I've ever seen, nobody murdered relievers more than Joe Torre did.
No, I'm not saying I agree with that argument. I'm just saying that's an argument people make. But
no, I'm switching what you said. I'm morphing that into the fact that this guy was not a lights out manager by any means.
No, and they lost like, however many years in a row in the first round of the playoffs. They couldn't get out of their own way, you know. And
well, what about blowing a 3-0 lead in the 2004 LCS?
That too, yeah, that's a problem, you know. That's obviously.
It's an issue.
It's an issue. It's a factor. And, you know, in the last thing he managed against Cleveland when they had the bugs on the field and he just sat there like half asleep instead of saying, like, we're taking the team off the field and we're spraying for bugs or whatever, you know, or raising some issue with the umpires. I mean, he just, like, sat there impassively, you know.
My biggest issue with him that we've talked about multiple times was I always thought the Red Sox intimidated the Yanks a little. They would throw inside because they knew Torre was doing the whole, hey, guys, we don't play that game.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, the Red Sox did, and they threw a Jeter just every series.
Yeah, he's been hit like 85 times, you know, since 02 or something by the Red Sox.
Yeah.
Now, and the Yankees would never, ever retaliate because, quote, that wasn't the Yankee way, and we're above it all and dignified.
And then this year, or maybe it started in 2007, but when Jabba threw it, Yukos a couple times.
Yeah, that was Red Sox.
Yeah, all the Red Sox fans were like, oh my God, he's a murderer. Like, but meanwhile, we'd been throwing a Jeter for the entire decade, trying to break his wrist, basically.
Right.
So I always thought that the whole, I never liked that part about his managing. I didn't feel like he stuck up for his players, and I thought he killed relievers. Obviously, he was the right guy in 96 through 99, and they had the right clubhouse for him, but I'm not sure he's equipped to handle some of these prima donnas they brought in. On the other hand, he did a nice job with Manny last year.
That is true. He did.
Got to hand him that.
Right. He did do a good job with that, and he was surprisingly, I mean, he sometimes needs his, like, mellow, handle the media, handle the egos well, but you know me, I always want, like, a Bobby Knight guy in there, like, turning over the tables and screaming at people, you know, like, give me Earl Weaver or somebody any day.
So, I had two. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
and I
want this laconic guy, like, sitting there, like, passively, like, oh, you know, reading the racing form and drinking his Bigelow tea, you know, while the Red Sox are trying to kill Jeter.
I had two issues with the book, other than what we discussed. First of all, he doesn't need the money.
Right.
There's no financial incentive for him. You can't tell me, like, at this point in his life that he's not financially set.
Right.
So, and he didn't write it himself. Which I think Phil Jackson was really involved in the writing process. He uses this guy, Charlie Rosen, who he's been friends with for 40 years, and they really collaborate when they write books. Joe Torre was basically like, yeah, I'll give you a month of interviews, and then you write it, and we'll put our name on it together.
And he got, you know, Verducci had access. It was like he could come in and hang out and write down stuff, and then, you know, Torre probably could take things out if he wanted to.
Yes.
So, but it was like, I don't think he was really all that involved in writing it. It was just like, all he did was tell Verducci, yeah, you can hang out in here in the manager's office and sit on the bench or whatever, you know?
So I just think his motives are really suspect. And the other issue I had was we're really only hearing one side of the story.
Right.
Like the excerpt I read in Sports Illustrated, he tells his side of the story of what happened when they flew him to Tampa to discuss a contract extension for 2008.
Yeah.
And everything from it was his side because Cashman didn't want to be interviewed, I don't think. And
he still won't comment about it.
And Hank Steinbrenner obviously isn't going to comment. So we hear all these stories, but it's Joe Torre's recollection of the stories, you know?
Right.
It's like if you and I had this major blowout and we never talked again. And then you wrote a book 3 years later of what happened and the details that led to that blowout and your history with me as a friend.
Right.
Which, by the way, I hope never happens.
don't drive me there.
You know, and you're like, the final time I had breakfast with Bill, we went to the diner, and I told Bill, and Bill looked at me with cold eyes. And, you know, we're hearing your side. We don't know.
And he has the gall to go on the air and say, like, oh, Brian and I, we talk all the time. We have a great relationship. If somebody wrote a book about me and was like, O'Connell was like this traitorous rat who like stabbed me right in the back at the most crucial moment of our friendship,
right.
I'd be like, well, we're still great friends. Oh, really? Really?
Well, that was pretty pointed in the excerpt was about
Oh, yeah.
He said to Cashman, hey, what if we do this and option and if whatever? And Cashman's like, yeah, I'll bring it to him. And then as they left the meeting after they had fired him, he was like, hey, did you ever ask them about that idea? And Cashman's like, oh, crap, hold on. Goes back in. I just refuse to believe that happened. I'm sorry.
And Cashman kind of looked at him and was like, I didn't really understand what you meant by that offer. Like, what? You know? And then it was like he was like, one, an idiot, and then he was like a rat and like a liar. It was like covered all the bases, you know?
Yeah. And he was like, and I asked Cashman, but Cashman was punching a homeless man at the time. And after he was done kicking the crap out of him and stealing his money, then he went back inside and asked.
Cashman had just finished shooting up heroin while dressed like the Gimp from Pulp Fiction. And I said, Brian, you know, we really have to talk about this.
And he's like, hold on a second. I want to convince Bernie Madoff to swindle all these people. I just got to take this one call. The only part I do believe that definitely happened is Hank Steinbrenner doing the, hey, what about you on the Yes Network next year?
Yeah.
Any thoughts? I could totally see Hank asking that.
Yeah, I can completely see that, too. Right. We don't want you to manage, but how'd you like to work with Susan Waldman on the Yes Network?
Good news. There's a Yes Network opening.
Right. Yeah, that rings very true. I can certainly see that, yes. That part I agree with.
Well,
and
you
the
know,
part about, like, he just apparently, like, raves about Jeter, like, you know, Jeter's like the second coming of Christ, basically. Which may be accurate, so that part of the book is probably true as well.
Well, I was a little torn because I just thought what Tory did was kind of semi-disgusting.
Yeah, I agree.
On the other hand, it caused a lot of turmoil with the Yankees.
Yeah, and it reopens a lot of old wounds. It'll be every question of spring training, A-Rod and Jeter, that whole soap opera again.
Yes, I love that. I love any A-Rod bashing I support fully. The single white female thing I just think was fantastic.
Yes.
It's one thing, you know, to just throw that analogy out, but then when that movie comes on cable now, you get to think about A-Rod, like, potentially kidnapping Jeter, getting the same haircut. And
why has no one photoshopped the thing of, like, Jeter and A-Rod with the short red hair, like, from that movie, like Bridget Fonda and Jennifer Jason Leigh?
Oh, I'm sure somebody has.
I just haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I'm sure it's on one of the kajillion sports
blogs.
It
should be, like, on the Boston Dirt Dogs or something. They're just waiting for the season, waiting for the first time the Yankees come into Boston.
You could probably do the hats and put, like, the red wig sprinkling out underneath. Underneath it or something.
Yeah.
So how did you feel about I've read Kirk Radomski's book.
Oh, really?
A lot of Yankees in that book, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Whole slew of Yanks.
I saw him on Outside the Lines or whatever a couple of weeks ago.
I gotta say, I believed him.
Sure,
he was so detailed.
Sure.
No, he was so detailed, and he was obviously not some, you know, like you read the stuff about people hung around Pete Rose, and those guys were just meatheads and losers and gophers. Like, this guy actually, like, knew steroids, knew what the different drugs did.
Yeah, he himself was, like, a bodybuilder and stuff.
Yeah, and he was like, this will do this. Like, there's a part where he tells Lenny Dykstra, don't use that one. You'll sweat it out as the season goes along, and that's what happened. But I was amazed by how many Yanks, and thank God that he was not involved with the Red Sox, because I'm sure a similar book could have been written about
that. Well, that's just it. I mean, the whole Mitchell report was he and McNamee, who both happened to work for the Mets and the Yankees, so it was very New York-centric, you know?
I love it.
They couldn't find some clubhouse kid or clubhouse attendant that worked for the Red Sox. None? None?
He's probably out there.
Yeah, there's probably one or two guys in the Red Sox I have a hint that maybe were involved with maybe some syringes at some point.
My favorite part of the book was when Mo Vaughn, like right at the tail end of his career, decides he needs something, and he does this, gets Mo the stuff and has this whole schedule, and Mo doesn't stick with the schedule and just completely ruins it. But sometimes he's giving himself the shots, but other times he forgot to bring it on the road with him. And it really made you think, like, wow, Mo Vaughn did not get enough credit for being not very smart.
Mo Vaughn wasn't even swift enough to break the rules in the right way.
Mo Vaughn's like, I forgot my stuff. Do they have it at the Foxy Lady?
Exactly.
They don't have it behind the bar. They don't have Inderol or whatever. I don't know. What's a steroid joke?
Noel. Yeah.
What joke? Hey, I heard Mike Francesa unveiled a new theme yesterday.
He did. I did. I heard that. I went out lunchtime. Yeah, it's kind of like a little bit of a it's kind of a rock and rollier version of the old song in a way.
What does it sound like?
I only heard it once, and I was like, wait, is that a new song? I didn't really like. I couldn't like hum it or repeat it, but it's kind of like the old Mike and the Mad Dog one, but it's a little bit like there's some electric guitar in it. It's a little more rock and rollish.
Hmm.
It's interesting. Yeah.
You don't want to hum it for us?
I will in a future podcast, but I don't really have it down yet.
You know, is there somebody singing? Is there somebody saying
oh,
like,
yeah,
they're going at it as hard as
I
can?
I think it's the same guy that used to sing like Turn It On and Triumph, you know, but it's like mic'd up Princess on the Fan. Yeah. It's basically, it's very similar to the old song. It's just like, it's jazzier.
Do you think that,
You know, what was interesting was when he was doing the first day from the Super Bowl from Tampa.
Yeah.
The Monday before the Super Bowl. And, went out and I had him on in the car and he's like, he goes, I'm here in Radio Row and just saw the dog before the show. He goes, we could have done another Mike and the Mad Dog, but then he went his way and I went mine. So here we are.
Really?
Yeah, I was kind of like, Jesus. It was like, it made it seem like they were like hanging out or palling around. I thought it would have been funny. Like they're both right there, probably like within a couple feet of each other. It would have been fun. Like, I don't know, they probably can't do it contractually, but if Mad Dog like popped in, Mike, how you been? How's the show? You know, like just a surprise thing. People would have gone nuts for that, you know?
Hey, Doug.
I saw him. We talked. He's doing good. Then he went his way, and I went mine.
Hey, Doug. No hard feelings. none on my side either, Mike. None at all. Those guys will be back together. If you had to guess a date, I'm going to go with March 3rd, 2010.
Really? That soon?
Yeah.
How's the Doug show doing? Is there any sense? You don't even hear about him anymore.
You Sirius?
I don't have Sirius or XM or whatever. So
Sirius is down to 15 cents on the stock. I don't know how much longer it's going to be around. I could see. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to play out. I put it this way. I would bet that those two will be back on the Fan together at some point. Because the key is that they haven't replaced Doc.
You know, I was reading in the New York Post. They had something the other day, or last week, and it was. Like five questions with Ian Eagle.
Yeah.
Tells you how exciting my life is that I was actually thumbing through the New York Post and reading five questions with Ian Eagle, the voice of the Nets.
Right.
And he was asked to be Francesa's partner. They asked him about it. He said no. He's like, there was a time I'd have killed for that job or would have been everything I wanted to do. But he's like, I'm just so focused on being the voice of the Nets that it wasn't the right timing.
What?
He's like, yeah. He's like, you know, they were like, how did that come about? And he's like, well, you know, I'm like the demographic. I was like younger and, you know, thought I could be like combative with Mike. I was familiar with the radio station and stuff. And Mike and Ian Eagle.
Well,
and he turned it down to do like the Nets.
I told you he called me too.
Yes.
I've never written about that, but yeah, he did. He did call. He definitely seemed like he wanted to get younger.
Yeah. And, so that was a thing. I guess he wants like a younger perspective.
And much like Ian Eagle, it's a job that at one time in my life I probably would have killed for.
Right.
But unfortunately, there's a thing now called contracts.
That too.
But, you know, it would have been interesting to do a radio show with anybody that's 5 hours a day, to see somebody 25 hours a week.
He did a 25-minute rant the other day, too, about how awful their studio is. And he said he could have gone on for like 5 hours. About how, like, there's, like, sewage, like, leaking from the ceiling, and it's never been updated from when it was built in, like, the 70s or whatever, and it's,
right.
Like, the worst hellhole on Earth, and every time they go to remotes, every single radio station, like, on Earth, like, there's radio stations in, like, Bangladesh that have nicer studios. He went on and on and on, so I'm like, sounds like a great place to work.
I went there once. It's, like, in the middle of nowhere in New York.
Yeah.
You would have thought they would have a studio on... You know, I don't
in
know,
Manhattan
Times Square,
or something.
Who knows, somewhere. But no, it was kind of like hard to get to, too.
He talked about how just disgusting and decrepit it was. And he's like, even though we're like the number one billing station in America or whatever. So it's not really like, it doesn't sound like a place you really want to like parachute in and start working, you know?
I think that should have been televised when him and the dog ran into each other at Radio Row.
That would have been great.
And then like shown as a montage with like Billy Joel's This Is the Time to Remember, like them hugging, you know, like one of those end of the game goosebump montages.
Exactly. One shouting moment type of thing.
I think it's sad though. I just breaking up those guys is depressing to me.
Yeah,
I haven't gotten over it yet.
I don't get the same thrill like listening to it now. I mean, I do because you can only listen to your iPod so much in the car and you want to hear the radio or whatever, but it's not the same as it used to be. Like, I used to really get like a kick out of it, and it's not as funny anymore. There's not really any comedy. It's all just like listening to him talk about sports. And his arrogance is kind of out of control. Like, a guy called up the other day and was saying that that Francesa didn't like Joe Montana because he was talking about like the five greatest quarterbacks of all time or something.
Right.
And Montana wasn't one of them. And he's like, the guy's like, you don't like Montana. You have a bias against Montana. And then Francesa got really mad and he goes, wait a second. He goes, I know Joe Montana. Only I know Joe Montana. You don't know him. And then the guy was like, oh, you're high and mighty. You know Joe Montana. And then he like backed down. But it was just such a like arrogant thing to say to some, you know, poor schmo who just called in and like Joe Montana, you know. He's like, I know him. I've actually met him. You ever met him? Oh, take it easy, you know.
Yeah, I think if there was a Mike and the Mad Dog movie, we're at like the 1 hour and 10 minute mark where it's like sad because they broke up and both guys are struggling on their own. But we're still headed for the Shawshank ending.
Yeah, they'll be on the beach in Mexico.
Yeah, I think Mike is going to bury a box in Bucksford, Maine. With instructions to the new W Fan Studio in Times Square and like $2,000.
Let's hope so. Let's hope they reunite. Yeah.
I felt sad. I mean, I was back home last week and my mom was driving us to the airport and it was a Monday. And normally I would have forced her to listen to Mike and the Dog, but instead we listened to Coffee House on Sirius.
Fantastic.
I don't know if you listen to Coffee House, but we listen to it a lot because we have two young kids and you want like semi-soothing music that still isn't, you know, is relatively tolerable.
Right.
Coffee House is fascinating, the people they push.
Who's like, on there? Like Sarah McLachlan? Like that type of thing?
Yeah, it's also people that you don't know the names. Like there's this guy that I now actively hate named Ray LaMontagne. LaMontagne or something. I don't know how to say his name, but you can see who the singer is on the box.
Okay.
And he sings these songs like, you know, I love you so much, you know, it burns me inside. Like, just these terrible, I apologize to everybody for my voice, but you know what I mean? Like these over-the-top, almost stalkerish lyrics. And of course, he's my mom's favorite coffee-ass person, but it's a lot like him, like the guy who sang on SNL last week, a lot of like Jack Johnson.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
John Mayer. But
yeah.
The thing I'm stunned by is, like, there's no Natalie Merchant.
It's really amazing.
Tracy Chapman's on all the time.
Oh,
like,
sure.
Sarah McLachlan, Tori Amos, all those people. But no Natalie Merchant. I'm convinced, like, she had an affair with somebody who's running Sirius, and that guy sent them an
email. Representation. They need to get involved in that.
I would have thought she would have been, like, one of the queens of the Coffee House channel.
I'm surprised you don't like Ray LaMontagne after your confession in the chat that you've actually downloaded from iTunes a Jamie Waters song.
Yeah, well, that was why, though. That's a good song.
I don't know how that one goes. I just remember his big hit, you know, How Do You Talk to an Angel or whatever, so.
Listen, I will stand by why. That's one of the better songs.
Now I've got to go home and get on iTunes and check out one Ray LaMontagne, and then I have to check out the Jamie Waters catalog.
Oh, he's Ray LaMontagne. Really needs to just be thrown in jail. I can't take it. Hey, we got to talk about the real world before I let you go.
All right.
Oh, and I also, while we were talking, I did IMDb that Joe Torre movie. It was called Joe Torre, Curveballs Along the Way.
Very good.
Based
on his first book.
This is quite a cast. Paul Sorvino is Joe Torre. Robert Loggia is Frank Torre. Why is that funny?
I don't know, but I think I like the way you say Robert Loggia.
And this is the best one. The part of Dwight Gooden? Isaiah Washington.
Oh, my God, no, really? The guy from Grey's Anatomy?
How great is that?
That's fantastic.
No other, I can't see any other. Kenneth Walsh played George Steinbrenner. I don't know who that is. It's funny, like, people played like Wade Boggs and Mariano Duncan and Paul O'Neill. Anyway, all right, Real World. So have you caught up?
I have watched all the episodes, yes.
Okay.
I'm current before, not obviously tonight's episode, but, you know, I am up to date.
Is this the final season for us?
You think it's enough? You think it's
could be it. I think when they played the transsexual card, I think that could have been it.
I think that was a bridge too far.
You know what though? I'm just totally absorbed.
You're still mesmerized by the show, though. Come on.
Every time she's on, I'm absorbed. Every time.
It's just fascinating. It's a fascinating turn of events. The best ever was when somebody emailed you, I think, and said, like, you know, what if you were the one, or it was your buddy, and you were like making out with some girl in a bar and like, you know, grinding with her or whatever.
And then saw it on the real world.
The real world that she may have had some issues in her background, so to speak.
It was really our dream come true in college and after college for that to happen with somebody we knew.
I know. I would love, obviously not to first be myself, but I would love if it was one of our friends. That would just end every conversation, you know. He could never say anything again.
It's a weird cast, though. I'm not sure if they have a single female cast member that I'm attracted to.
I'll answer that for myself. No, there's not.
Okay.
And there's a lot of things on it are fascinating to me, but we were watching it, a bunch of us, last week on like a Friday night when they replay it, and we had a few drinks. The girl that wants to be a professional dancer cannot dance.
Yeah, it's a problem.
She's the most unrhythmic person I've ever seen, and believe me, I'm not like Jerry Rice or whoever won Dancing with the Stars. I can't dance to save my life. But she's really bad. I don't try to do it professionally. I mean, she's really like noticeably bad.
I think she'd be good in a bar if she was drunk and you'd be like, wow, that girl, she has some moves, but not in a way that would translate to like Broadway.
When she went to like some dance class thing and you're watching it and you're like, God, she's going to like hurt somebody or herself. Like she's really like awful.
Yeah.
So you have that guy. You have the Gulf War guy.
Yeah.
Who
I like that guy.
I do too. And some of his songs weren't bad.
Right.
But the most awkward thing ever is when he goes in some guy Machine who's a record producer.
Yeah, and that was the song he played about a tampon.
Exactly. That's like a joke song.
Yeah.
And he relied for advice on the Mormon, who's an idiot.
Yeah.
I don't mean that as a pejorative against Mormons. I don't know his name, and that's his claim to fame on the show.
His name is Chet.
Chet, who's an idiot. And he goes to him and says, like, what should I play? And he tells him that song. He plays it. Machine's like, okay, great. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, just realized I have a 315.
Yeah. I mean, that was so freaking awkward.
I loved it. It was awkward, but in a good way.
Oh, man, I felt so bad for that guy. Because some of his other songs, like about, you know, the guy in Iraq and his girlfriend breaks up with him and he writes a song about she's a liar. Like, that was a good song, you know?
My favorite part, not involving any scenes of whatever her name is on the treadmill, Andrew Bogut. My favorite part was when they go to the gay bar for the first time. And that guy Chet, who's like, yeah, everybody thinks I'm gay. I don't know. It's
right.
I'm not gay. Look, I'm not gay, guys. So he decides to go to the bar wearing like a purple scarf and like a yellow hat
and eye makeup.
Eyeshadow.
Right.
It's like, you know, Chet, people have a right to ask some questions, maybe. And then a girl liked him in the last episode, and he had some quote like in the confessional. He said, you know, she's attracted to me, and that kind of thing happens. It was like talking about, it sounded like LeBron James after like a January game against Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah, that guy, I mean,
I think he comes out by the end of the year.
If he wears one more lavender scarf and puts on eye makeup one more time, I mean, there's just no question, is there?
No.
I mean, there's just none.
And then the JD who came out, that's his name, right?
Yeah, who trains dolphins.
Who really might have the biggest schism ever between sober personality and non-sober personality. he turns into basically Archie Bunker.
Yeah, he's awful.
It's great. I'm kind of enjoying the season. I just feel like I'm too old for the show, and it makes me just feel bad about myself.
When he's sober, he's like the voice of reason and like you know, and Mr. Dignified, and then he has a few drinks, and he's just like throws everybody completely under the bus.
Were you talking about you or JD?
A little of both. I see a lot of myself in JD. No pun intended.
It's been definitely like a riveting season.
Right.
It's an atypical real world season.
It's not as exciting as others though. Like there's not a lot of like drama or conflict.
You know why?
You know.
But let's be honest. It's because they don't have a smoking hot girl in the cast.
That's part of it too. I really need that to draw my interest.
Yeah, it's an eclectic cast that is not really.
How about the guy from New Hampshire that's like the bodybuilder? Is he involved in the show at all? Like, is he ever there? He's like never in anything.
The meathead?
At the gym?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's just at the gym, and they probably went and filmed scenes of him working out, and they're like, okay. Yeah.
We'll just run that on a loop, I guess. Yeah.
Well then, any interest in maybe asking out the girl who hands out towels? No, I'm not interested. Okay, all right. We'll see you next episode. Thanks. Good luck with your sets.
How about the girl with the black hair who looks exactly like Reese Witherspoon?
Yeah, she's like tattooed crazy Reese Witherspoon.
But doesn't she look exactly like her?
She's got the jaw.
She looks, I think she's like a twin, except for the piercing through her lip, but.
Bad news, Reese Witherspoon just killed herself.
Sorry, Reese.
Hey, the other show I asked you to watch so we could discuss is Confessions of a Teen Idol.
I've only seen one.
Was that enough?
Pretty much, yeah. Because nobody on there is really like, I mean, Adrian Zemed, am I getting excited about that?
Well, you weren't really in the, you weren't a 90210 guy, so Jamie Walters isn't really going to push you over the top.
Right, no, not really. So it's like, I mean, I watched the one episode where they went on a tour of their old haunts or whatever. And like that, I was just like, and I didn't understand why Scott Baio felt the need to like go into the therapy session. I'm going in. It was like super dramatic. I'm like, I don't quite get this, you know?
Yeah, when Scott Baio is like your best case scenario for coming out of the show with a career, maybe, yeah. Maybe that's not good.
And the guy from Fame, I wouldn't know that guy. Like if he came in here and, you know, shook my hand, I still don't know who that guy is.
I wrote about that in the chat. I'm convinced.
I think you were right. It was like a last-minute replacement.
Not even last minute. It might have even been last second. like they had just started. They had set up the camera crew, and they were just about to start filming, and somebody backed out, and he happened to be, like, working on somebody's garden. And they were like, isn't that Billy Huffsey from Fame? Throw him in. Get him a shirt. And that's how I ended up on the show. When you and I both don't know who somebody is who was on a TV show,
yeah,
that's some trouble.
Not good, yeah. So, I don't know. That show is...
What else are you watching? Anything?
I'm trying to think. We're still late. We still like The Office. My wife got me into this new show that's on CBS called The Big Bang Theory. It's like about these nerds and this hot chick lives across the hall from them. It's kind of
like
funny, though.
Yeah?
I think like five people watch it. It's going to be off the air next week. But
it's a nice name. I like the name.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, we're watching... trying to think. I continue to enjoy American Idol.
I literally have never watched an episode of that show in my life.
That's where I was last year. Last year was the first season I got into it, and now, like this season, I look forward to it. I enjoy it. And it's one of the great TiVo shows because you can really fast forward over all the crap and watch it in about 25 minutes.
It's just the same thing over and over, and these like cheesy songs, and I don't know.
It's solid. For some reason, Simon... I really wish that Simon, there was an equivalent of him in sports.
We've already selected Clay Aiken. We've already achieved the absolute top that you can possibly pick. Shouldn't they have just quit right then and there?
I wish if there was a Simon for sports, though, it's like, you know, like we argue about Kobe's 61-point game, whether he was selfish or not. And we'd have our arguments, and then now Simon would weigh in at the end and determine who was right. That's basically the power that he has on this show.
Is LeBron going to go in tonight and score 62 just to put an exclamation point on things and top Kobe?
It's going to be interesting because his team's a little banged up, too.
He might just say, I'm at Madison Square Garden. My boy Jay-Z is here. I'm just going to put up 70.
I love the fact that Spike Lee called Kobe a genius after, but then it came out that they're doing a documentary together and Kobe was looping sound bites for it that night. He's a genius. Great effort. Hey, Kobe. 11 o'clock, recording studio.
How about the Knicks fans chanting MVP and applauding for him?
Well, they weren't. Those weren't Knicks fans. This is a common confusion sports thing that seems to happen where you have fans of the other team buying tickets and chanting. Yeah, this happened at the Celtic game 2 years ago, too. Last question. What are the Yanks going to do?
They're done? What's that? Oh, in terms of, our Cashman was in Connecticut yesterday at some Chamber of Commerce meeting, a breakfast meeting, and he said, according to the paper today, that they're tapped out.
Really?
Money-wise. The Boston Globe, I was reading a blog on there, and they seem to think that, of course, this is the paranoia of Red Sox Nation, which is always good, but they seem to think Manny will be their DH, that they're not going to go and have a season with an outfield of... Nady, Damon, and Cabrera. I'm not sure about their World Series outfield.
I feel like that's why Boris hasn't been jumping at any of these offers.
Well, you would just think there's got to be something lurking in the weeds, and I keep thinking like A-Rod came to them around Valentine's Day, so you wonder if this year will be like the Manny arrival. You know, it just seems weird that he, you know.
If Manny signed with the Yankees, I think this becomes the greatest season in the history of the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
So much. Those games will be, when he comes to Fenway in a Yankee uniform, first of all, it's going to kill me. But I just think that the electricity in the ballpark is going to be there. It's going to be great.
Oh, my God, it'll be like the Roman Coliseum, like '03 and '03 that I was, when Zimmer got thrown down. That was the most frightened I've ever been at a sporting event. The crowd really wanted, like, blood.
Yeah, but everybody was united in hatred for Clemens.
Right.
This is going to be a whole other level because there's people who are still mad that Manny left and like him.
So there'll be, like, a little torn.
Yeah, I think it's going to be... it's going to be indescribable. I don't know if there's been another... I'm sure there has. I guess it would be like Tom Seaver coming back to Shea, something like that, although Seaver was more popular.
But he was traded, though.
Yeah, and he was more popular. I don't know. It's one of those things that it's been so polarizing. I argue about it all the time with people. Like, I can't handle the fact that the Nationals have not offered him $100 million for 3 years yet.
Well, I mean, the guy's the best hitter in baseball, and I realize he's a head case and you have to baby him, but I just don't get these teams that are like, oh, we don't want any part of him. Please. He'll only help us win the World Series.
Yeah, he'll only win us 95 games like he does every year since 1992.
He's only going to hit 45 home runs and with 140 RBIs. We want no part of that.
He's only going to be going for all these personal records that will potentially be among the top five in baseball.
Yeah, we wouldn't want anybody like that in our team.
I don't get it.
Doesn't make any sense.
I feel like there's more to the story that they're not telling us.
Could be. Maybe it'll come out in Joe Torre's next book.
All right. Good segue back to the top.
The Dodger years.
Joe Mead, are we going to play a little Theocracy quickly or no?
We potentially can. I have it. I just got to make sure it plays.
Yeah, people have been calling for...
Theocracy.
Yeah, just to end one of these Jacko segments with
Sounds
Theocracy
good.
For all time's sake. It's been a while.
Fantastic.
We're going to ask them to write something because Subway is going to start sponsoring us soon for your podcast.
Excellent.
Well, maybe
it's a look at.
Oh, what was that? That's the worst Theocracy song I've ever heard. Jacko, this is my year of torturing Joe Mead, I've decided.
You're going to work him into the program. It's like what was the guy's name on Regis and Kathy Lee?
I want him to be like Kirk Radomski, just completely bitter by the time it's over, ready to write a tell-all book.
Nice. I might need him to urinate for me, too.
You have to go?
No. I just meant, like, Radomski was, like, urinating in the cup for Dwight Gooden.
Oh, yeah. He covered that in the book, and he said that by the fourth time it got awkward. He was like, Doc, because the first time Doc's like, hey, man, I went out with some friends, and I don't think I'm going to pass my drug test. And he's like, oh, yeah, Doc, hold on, let's do this. And then, like, a week later, Doc's like, hey, I might have gone out last night, and it just kind of kept happening. So finally he was like, Doc, I think you have a problem.
Man, oh, man.
Yeah. That continues to be the documentary that nobody's done. That would be awesome.
Yeah, or even like a real movie, like not a documentary, like, you know.
The 86
Isaiah Washington could play him again.
I'd also like to see a documentary about why it's taken Joe Mead so long to find this Theocracy song. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Hopefully the Yankees don't sign Manny. That'll be the toughest podcast I've ever done.
Great. I look forward to that one.
Okay.
Later.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.